Good morning, everyone. Looking this morning at Lesson 11 from our new book, Path to Shiva. First, I'll read the short text and then I'll make some comments on it. Lord Shiva is the supreme being of the universe. He, she is all and in all, both the creator and the creation, within everything and beyond everything at the same time. Shiva has a threefold nature. His highest reality is beyond time and form. His second aspect is the divine mind existing here, there, and everywhere. His third aspect is the personal Lord, the creator and source of all time and all form. Only in the deepest meditation can the nature of such a vast and mysterious God be fully known. The name Shiva means the auspicious, gracious, or kindly one. Shiva is the one supreme being that all faiths have worshipped by many names and sought to understand for thousands of years. Shiva has five powers: creation, preservation, destruction, and the twin graces of concealment and revelation. He creates the three worlds from his own being, and he also preserves the three worlds, dancing in each tiny atom at every point in time. Ultimately, he absorbs creation back into himself. He does this in great cycles of time spanning billions of years. Then in the next grand cycle of time, he creates again. Shiva is also the creator of individual souls like us. With his fourth and fifth powers, concealing and revealing, Shiva governs and guides our evolution as a parent guides a child. We should always worship this great God of love and never fear him. He is the self of ourself, closer than our breath. Gurudeva taught, his nature is love, and if you worship him with devotion, you will know love and be loving toward others. Shiva is the sun above us, the wind that cools the land, the five elements, the thought within our mind, the spark of light within our body, that which lives and that which is inert. Beyond knowing, beyond gender, he, she is the deathless being who resides beyond the three worlds yet stands in souls united. Interesting, one of the textbooks I refer to now, and that is called Saiva Vinavidai. Vinavidai means question and answer, or said another way, catechism. Aramuga Navalar wrote it. He starts the same way we do. We started here. Lord Shiva is the supreme being of the universe. So he does question and answer. Who is the Lord of the world? Shiva Paramat. First sentence. Exactly the same. There's a story I read in one of our presentations on Yerevan Temple. It's from the 2007 article Associated Press wrote about Yerevan Temple, to be precise, published in over 100 major newspapers in North America, plus a few in other countries. So it was got very large distribution, and fortunately, it was very positive. When newspapers write about Hinduism, it always doesn't come out positive. Particularly in India, they have a rule of thumb that they can't say anything positive about Hinduism. In India. You have to come to the U.S. to find a newspaper that says positive things about Hinduism. Oh, the article is very poetic. It starts, in a clearing within Kwai Adinam's lush gardens, the ping, ping, pinging of metal chipping at stone can be heard over the sounds of bird calls. A half dozen artisans from South India put the finishing flourishes on the Hindu monastery's legacy for the ages. Hand-carved in granite and shipped in pieces to the island from India, the Yerevan Temple is faithful to the precise design formulas defined by South Indian temple builders 1,000 years ago. The $8 million temple to the god Shiva is the first hand-carved all-stone Hindu temple outside of India, according to the Kwai monks. The project is a rarity even in India. Sounds pretty good, right? But there's one phrase that I wish we could have edited, and that reads, Yerevan is a temple to the god Shiva. So it makes Shiva sound like one of many gods, right? the temple to the god Shiva. So Gurudeva chose the names of our temples to avoid that. As in Kadavul and Erevan, Tamil language, mean God. There's no one of the gods association. In fact, it's quite common in books. It just starts out in praise of God. Kadavul Valtu. Praise of God is a very common way of starting a book. So Gurudeva wanted to make clear that these are temples to the Supreme Being. And we happen to call the Supreme Being Shiva. But the temple is to the Supreme Being, if not to one of many gods. I have a way of talking about Shiva and Vishnu. I went to a number of Venkateshwara temples that were having Kumbhabhishekams. Over a period of 5 years, I think I went to 4 Venkateshwara temples. That's because there's lots of people from Andhra Pradesh in the U.S. There's more people from Andhra Pradesh than from Tamil Nadu by far. So there's lots of temples to Venkateshwara. And I developed a presentation. There I am sitting there with my 3 stripes, you know, in the middle of a group of Vaishnavites, and I asked the question, who do you think is the greater God, Shiva or Vishnu? Get everyone's attention, right? So I'm sure lots of them think, oh, he's going to say Shiva, you know. There he is with his 3 stripes and all. We're in trouble here today. So I say they're equal. Why are they equal? Because each is the supreme being, but to a different Hindu denomination. So to Shaivites, Shiva is the supreme being. To Vaishnavites, Vishnu is the supreme being. So one can't be greater than the other. It's just 2 different names, 2 different concepts for the supreme being. So that's why it's equal. The lesson touches on the 3 perfections of Shiva, but there's a second lesson on that which develops it further, so I won't mention that one. The 5 actions are important, and that's one of the benefits of having a Nataraja in the shrine. If you're explaining the temple to someone, you can just point to Nataraja, point to the symbolism, and show creation, preservation, destruction, veiling, and revealing grace right in the symbols. So you can show all 5 actions in a very nice way that Shiva does 5 things. And of course, the one that's not necessarily clear is the veiling grace. So I thought there was a nice wording on that in Saiva Vinavidai. He goes through all 5. What is veiling? Plunging of the souls in the objects of experience, which are the effects of the 2 kinds of karmic actions. Plunging of the souls in the objects of experience. When I present it in a class, I have 5 flowers for Shivaya Nama. So you have to imagine that, because I don't have 5 flowers. It's hard to find 5 flowers in this weather. So you have to imagine Shivaya Nama. So the ya is the soul. It's in the middle. Na is the veiling grace. Ma is the world. Va is the revealing grace. Shiva, she is Shiva, God. So you're in the middle. The soul's in the middle. One side is pulled by the veiling grace toward the world, and the other side is pulled by revealing grace toward God. Well, when you look at it that way, it makes you think that veiling grace is bad. I don't want to get pulled toward the world. But that's a misinterpretation. It's better to look at it in another way. Say you plant a seed in the ground. Is it bad to be in the ground rather than the air? No, it's where you start, right? You start in the ground, then you pop up, and then you if it's a flower, then you have a bud, and then you bloom. So you start in the ground. So likewise, the soul starts with experience in the world. That's why Patanjali says the world is here, or prakriti in his terminology, for two purposes, to provide experience and to provide liberation. Well, experience first comes by being in the ground. You know, it's not that wonderful an experience. It's nicer to be a bud and opening up in the sun, right? So it starts with experience in the world, and people that are in that stage of evolution don't necessarily participate in religion at all, or if they do, they may participate based on fear. They go to the temple because they're afraid if they don't, something bad will happen. But you're not very religious when we start as a soul. And then we get a little more religious, but we're still mainly concerned about the world, and then a little more religious, and then we get to the point where we're about equal in each. We're enjoying being in the world and things, but we're also enjoying getting to know God, getting closer to God, and that's when religion really becomes strong. Gurudeva puts that idea another way when he defines moksha. He has a couple of definitions of moksha. If you think of moksha, you would generally just think of, well, we need to realize God and then we'll be free from rebirth. Moksha is based upon realization. If you think a little deeper, you'd say, well, let's see, I guess karma could bring me back, so maybe I better resolve all my karma too. I have to realize God, but I have to resolve all my karma, otherwise I'll come back, even though I realize God, to fulfill some karma. So we have to resolve all karma, as well as realize God. But then Gurudeva adds a third one, which is fulfill all dharma. We have to have experience. We have to do different things in the world. We have to be parents and raise children. We have to be a professional and handle responsibility. We have to have experiences in the world to mature us. That's why Hindu thought the world is an ashram. If we look at it the right way, it's maturing us spiritually. It's not making us worldly. Once we are in this place where we're interested both in the world and God, then we start looking at the world not as a worldly place, but as a place where we gain self-mastery over our emotions, where we learn to take on greater and greater responsibility. We move toward imperturbability, which sometimes I twist my tongue on. I got it out that time. Imperturbability is the goal. Nothing upsets us. We have such self-control that nothing upsets us. As I told one monk once who tended to get upset when he was young, said, even if you knew the world was going to end in 5 minutes, you shouldn't become upset. What's the benefit? Getting upset is just giving away your best intelligence. You become a little bit stupid if you become upset. Well, there's no advantage to it, right? Why give away your intelligence by letting something upset you? So that's experience. So we need experience in the world, and that's the idea of veiling grace. We just don't want to sit all day at the feet of God. We want to do something in the world. We need that veiling grace to cause us to mature. Otherwise, we just sit at the feet of God as an immature soul. We haven't matured, so we can't have the highest realizations. We can have devotion, but we can't have the highest realizations because we haven't gotten matured by the world. All of that is in that veiling grace. Destruction is an interesting one. Destruction sounds bad, right? Uh-oh. When we think of destruction, think in Hawaii, I think of a hurricane for some reason. Somewhere else, you may think of earthquakes, California. Somewhere else, you think of tsunamis. Anyway, those are very destructive events. But the kind of destruction I was thinking of is called disruptive technology. Looking at a YouTube video on the disruptive technology of electric vehicles and of energy over the next couple of decades. And the author gives the example that when the Model T came out, he had a picture of the streets of Manhattan, and there was a couple of Model Ts and everything else. 95-98% of what you saw on the street was horse-drawn carriages. Then 10 years later, the same street, he had a picture. There were about two horse-driven carriages, and 98% of what you saw was the Model T. So the Model T took away the whole horse and carriage industry. You didn't want to be a blacksmith at that time, right? Be out of work. Needed to learn how to be a blacksmith, needed to learn to be mechanics. So technology can just come in and change things. So that's a type of destruction as well. It's a good type of destruction. It's a progress, it's causing progress. One technology is coming in, replacing another. Or something in our life can do that. We can upgrade something in our life. One type of pattern in our life has gone away and we've replaced it with a more refined pattern. That's a kind of destruction as well. Something's gone away. Simple one is letters. I get a couple of letters a year now. Generally, they're handwritten by people that have beautiful penmanship. You know. But everything else comes in on email. So email has really disrupted paper mail, causing the post office to run at a loss, etc. But it's so much more efficient, right? So you get an email there, and then you can instantly answer it, and particularly if they're overseas. Used to be if you were writing to India, take 2 weeks for the letter to get there, then Indian time, you know, you have to answer it on an auspicious day, at an auspicious time. That could be a while. And 2 weeks to get back. So it would take 6 to 8 weeks to get an answer from India. So the pace of life in interacting with India was very slow, or now it's instantaneous. You know, they can. There's times of the days where you can just communicate instantaneously on email or on Skype, different things, because the time difference works for part of the day to do that. Well, it's totally changed, but consequently, anybody involved in letters, that whole area has gone down significantly. And that's the end of my thoughts. Have a wonderful day.